Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
And welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, a nurse in Spain has become the first person known to have caught the Ebola virus outside Africa. As Europeans ask, how could this happen? We talk to a German infectious disease physician.
There must be some kind of gap in the protection measures, since we know that Ebola virus is only transmitted from one person to the other person by direct contact.
Uhuru Kenyatta is now in the Netherlands, where he is set to appear before the International Criminal Court as a private citizen, not as the president of Kenya. This analyst tells us why.
I think it is because Kenyatta was charged as Kenyatta, you know, in his individual capacity and not as the President of the Republic of Kenya.
Those two stories and much else besides coming up in the next 25 minutes. Do stay with us.
Top story.
The European Union is now facing the first case of Ebola transmission within its borders. A nurse from Spain, who did not leave the country, has calmed down with the disease in Madrid. She was among medical staff who had cared for a patient who had become infected in Liberia. The European Union wants Spain to explain how the infection came to pass. Informed medical opinion says it shouldn't have happened. Dr. Thorsten Felt is an infectious disease physician at the University Hospital in Düsseldorf. I asked him to explain what could have gone wrong in Madrid.
Well, let me say first, we don't have any exact information about which protection measures have been used. The Spanish authorities say that WHO indicated guidelines have been respected. So we have no idea and no real exact information what went wrong. But there must be some kind of gap in the protection measures, since we know that Ebola virus is only transmitted from one person to the other person by direct contact.
Could the disease spread here in Europe?
No. We are really convinced that there is no risk that the disease could really spread. It is always possible, like in this case, that the well-now confirmed Ebola-infected patient had contact, close contact to family members and other persons, and that those persons get infected. But once the diagnosis is made here in Europe, in Germany, in Spain, and in other European countries, there is a very well surveillance infrastructure, and the health authorities are very alert and trace those contact cases and observe them very well once the infection is diagnosed.
But what should be done to protect health workers in future?
The first and important step and measure and action is to really identify those infected persons very early, to avoid and exclude that those persons who have symptoms and might have an Ebola infection have contact to other persons and are able to spread the infection. This is most important. This is what happened in the USA with the Dallas patient, who was obviously sent home in spite of reporting that he was coming from an infection area. So it's most important to really be alert, to ask those patients presenting with fever if they have traveled to areas where Ebola infection is ongoing.
How big a problem is the disposal of infectious waste?
In Europe, it's no problem, because all the units who care for those patients should have something we call an autoclave. So every waste which is disposed and which is possibly contagious is heated to a certain temperature for a certain time to make sure there is no infectious particle virus in this waste, and it can be discarded without any risk of infection for the environment. Of course, in Africa, where you don't have those technical facilities, where disposal often is just burned behind the hospital and it might be incompletely burned, this is a serious problem, because definitely the waste contains infectious particles, viral viruses, and might pose a risk to the environment.
Dr. Thorsten Feld from the University Hospital in Dusseldorf. Uganda's Ministry of Health has opened isolation centres to accommodate the ever-increasing number of people suspected of carrying the deadly Marburg virus, which is similar in some ways to Ebola. Official figures say that 83 people are already in centres in Entebbe and Kampala. One person, a health worker in the central Uganda district of Mpigi, has died of the virus. His brother is now one of the suspected carriers. President Museveni has appealed for calm and urged people to cooperate with the health workers. From Kampala, Alex Jitter reports.
Kampala has come under high alert after cases of the Marburg virus have been reported. Health officials believe there could be more infected people unknowingly passing on the disease to others. Isolation centres have been set up in Entebbe and Kampala for easy access by all suspected cases. The government is working with international health organisations to contain the situation. But the permanent secretary of the Ministry of Health, Asuman Lukwago, told DW Radio on phone that there are a number of calls reporting more suspected cases. These are not yet in the isolation centres.
Yesterday we had estimated about 80, but we are getting some calls suggesting that about more 20 or 30 could have also gone to visit him, so we are yet to meet them.
Government is using camps that were used to handle cases of Ebola in the past to hold suspects for screening. Unfortunately, amongst the suspects are health workers who could have come into contact with the only victim so far. Dr. Baterana Byarugaba, the director of Uganda's biggest referral hospital, Mulago, in the capital, Kampala, is optimistic the hospital is equipped to handle this latest outbreak.
The former Ebola camp is being prepared for that purpose. We are really moving on very well. We have already put up teams within Mulago Hospital, so for us, we can't lag behind.
It is not the first time Uganda is hit with a disease with epidemic proportions. Ebola, for example, another highly hemorrhagic fever, has attacked the East African country 3 times in the past 4 years. Although there has been an ongoing campaign by government to sensitize people on how to avoid such outbreaks, the majority of the population remains ignorant.
I think many Ugandans don't know about Marburg. They don't know the symptoms. They don't know how to avoid it or prevent it. So they need to know.
Well, I know it's a highly contagious fever where an infected person starts oozing blood and vomiting blood until maybe they die.
Marburg, what is Marburg? Do I know? I don't know Marburg, but I've heard about, I've read something Marburg, but I don't know how it is contracted. People just know it's fever. In fact, some people are mistaking it with Ebola.
Government has issued statements in the media to publicize the symptoms and also sending out officials to do radio and TV programs. Experts say there is no cause for alarm. Uganda's Deputy Minister for Health, Elioda Tumusje, says the fatality rate is quite high.
The case fatality rates vary from 24% to 88%, indicating that if you have like 100 people who contract this disease, maybe 24 to 88 of them will die.
Tumusje Elioda, Uganda's Health Minister, ending that report by Alex Jitter.
Africa Link, bringing you the story behind the story.
To Malawi now, where a court has handed down the first jail term in the country's huge financial scandal, which prompted foreign donors to pull the plug on aid. The amount of money stolen by corrupt officials was around 158 million euros, a vast sum in the impoverished country. Teresa Senzani, a former principal secretary for tourism and wildlife, was given prison sentences totaling 3 years and 9 months for her part in the swindle. George Mahango in Blantyre has more details.
High Court Judge Ivy Kamanga charged Teresa Senzani with charges of theft by public servant, money laundering and public funds plunder of financial resources in what is dubbed Cashgate. But Senzani's lawyer Necton Muhura had earlier on pleaded with the court not to pass a custodial sentence on his client because she had demonstrated remorse for her actions by returning the stolen money to government in the form of cash and a house valued at $155,000. Mhura also claimed that Senzani had cooperated with the prosecution and did not waste the court and prosecution's resources through a lengthy trial. He also mentioned her age 65 and that she had been dismissed from her job as mitigating factors for not imposing a custodial sentence on Senzani.
We are obviously disappointed by the ruling. We did put up a good fight, especially citing the principles that are very clear in the law that a first-time offender doesn't deserve a custodial sentence. If he does, it must be on very, very good reasons.
Outside the courtroom, which was packed with sympathizers and government officials, various Malawians hailed the ruling.
It will serve as a warning to those would-be offenders and even those already facing similar charges in various courts.
In my view, I see that justice has prevailed here. How can one pocket such money, which would have bought medical drugs, excise books for public schools and health facilities?
Beware when you are a government official, because time is gone for abuse of office and public plunder.
State Prosecutor Renick Matemba, who is Anti-Corruption Bureau Deputy Director, said Senzani obtained $155,000 from government coffers knowing she would be punished and lose her job when caught. He said Malawians are victims of this crime because donors suspended aid.
Honestly, we're happy with the ruling. As you'd recall, in our submissions, what we are fighting for was a custodial sentence, not a suspended sentence. Yes, she pleaded guilty, and the restitution was made, but when you look at the gravity of the offences that we charged her, theft and money laundering, they are serious offences.
Last year, a group of donors under the Common Approach to Budgetary Support, CABS, suspended direct aid to Malawi government due to the public plunder of financial resources. It is not known whether Senzani will appeal against the ruling.
George Mahango in Blantyre.
Africa on the Move.
And in this week's Africa on the Move, we head for the African cotton industry. Now, 10% of the world's cotton comes from Africa, but most of it isn't processed at home, but in Asia. However, this trend could be about to change, as some of Africa's cotton growers are determined to spin themselves a brighter future. This report by Andreas Becker has been adapted for Africa Link by Assumpta Latus.
François Traoré grows cotton in Burkina Faso. He's among 450,000 farmers from six African countries whose cotton runs under the label Cotton Made in Africa, an initiative that wants to create better conditions for African farmers on the global market. By joining the initiative, Traoré agreed to refrain from using chemicals on his crops and eventually sent his children to school. In exchange, he receives training in modern agricultural techniques, a financial advance for seeds and fertilizer, and slightly higher price for his cotton. Traoré, however, still has worries about his family's future.
It's a paradox. We send our children to school, but later they find no work. Through the cotton we produce, we actually create work for people in other countries, and these people then sell the manufactured goods back to us. That is why Africa is being destroyed.
In the 1980s, many African countries did have textile industries. These were, however, squeezed out of the market through competition from Asia, says a Kenyan businessman, Jas Bedi, who is also the chairman of the board of the African Cotton and Textile Industries Federation.
In Africa, the average spindle speed is about 10,000 RPM. And that same spindle running in China is running at 20,000 RPM. That means the Chinese spindle or the Indian spindle is producing twice as much, irrespective of the cost of electricity. And then when you look at the cost of electricity, if you're buying electricity at 20 US cents a kilowatt hour and India's at 10 cents and China's at 10 cents, so you're actually four times worse off.
The first major textile firms are already showing interest in moving part of their production to Africa. The Swedish labor H&M is, for instance, building a factory in Ethiopia. The US company PVH, which produces labels like Calvin Klein and Tommy Hilfiger, soon plans to start production in Kenya. the Turkish garment manufacturer Aika, which produces textiles for the German company Chibo, among others, has also opened a branch in Ethiopia in which it has invested $160 million. It currently employs around 7,000 people and soon hopes to scale the number up to 10,000. Kemal Osnayan is in charge of Aika's overseas branches. Osnayan also admits that textiles investors like Aika are still rare in Ethiopia and therefore enjoy a somewhat special status.
In Ethiopia, I have Prime Minister's direct telephone. I have all ministers' telephone. They are always open. So when we have some problems, I have correct numbers in my mobile, so asking how it goes. So in Ethiopia, we are doing that way.
This shows how some governments have been trying to open their arms towards foreign investors. However, it's not a standard case enjoyed by all who have their eyes set on Africa. In the World Bank 2014 Doing Business report, it stated that African countries like Rwanda, Burundi, and Ivory Coast had taken some of the best steps to ease business relations with investors.
And that report was written by Andreas Becker. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has arrived in the Netherlands for pre-trial hearings at the International Criminal Court, where he is set to face charges of organising mass ethnic violence. Deputy President William Ruto has taken charge of the government, and Kenyatta has said he was stepping down temporarily from his high office so he could appear before the court as a private individual. I asked Kenyan political analyst Peter Wendo why Kenyatta had decided not to appear in court as president.
I think it is because Kenyatta was charged as Kenyatta, you know, in his individual capacity and not as the president of the Republic of Kenya. If you recall, the charges were pressed against him when he was not the president. And so just because he assumed office, he still remains an accused person before the ICC in his capacity as Uhuru Kenyatta.
But for a Kenyan president to step down before appearing in a court of law is unprecedented. Is there any provision for this or something similar in the Kenyan constitution?
We need to make it clear from the onset. The president has not stepped down as the president. Uhuru Kenyatta has not ceased to be the president of the Republic of Kenya. What he has done is for him, and it's provided for under the constitution, that is Article 147.3, the president can always temporarily give powers to the deputy president to act as the president in situations where he is either absent from the country or he cannot perform his duties. And therefore, the president in this case has not ceased to be the president of the republic, but he has appointed his deputy, as provided for in the constitution, to be the acting president for the time that he'll be in the Netherlands. And again, also just to make it clear that he'll be attending the status conference. It's not the actual trial. He's just heeding to the summons of the court where he was requested to appear in person for the status conference, which I'm sure will be defining the way forward in terms of how his trial shall proceed, if at all it will proceed.
But the deputy president, William Ruto, is on trial and his trial resumes at the ICC on November the 11th. Couldn't that cause yet more headaches for the Kenyan government?
I don't think so. I think one of the requests that both Ruto and Uhuru have done is to ask the ICC to ensure that the way their trials will run, assuming the president's trial also commences, is that at least they should not run concurrently, so that one of them is always back at home to continue with their constitutional and political duties as the president and or the deputy president of the republic. So personally, I don't think there is going to be any problem. And with this decree that the president signed, where he allowed the deputy president to act as the president, automatically lapses when the president comes back. The constitution does not give clear provisions on how it will be revoked, but it shall be assumed that as soon as the president comes, then he continues with his duty as the president. And the mischief that this provision was trying to heal was to ensure that at no given time is there a vacuum in the exercise of the office of the presidency. And so I don't think there'll be a
Kenyan political analyst Peter Wendo.
Making a difference.
According to recent figures released by the group Human Rights Watch, one in seven girls in the developing world gets married before her 15th birthday, and the two countries where such unions are most prevalent are Niger and Chad. Rights activists say that child marriage frequently brings a girl's education to an end, as she is expected to take on responsibilities in the home. Deprived of schooling, she finds her choices and opportunities limited for the rest of her life. In Making a Difference this week, Columbus Mavhunga meets a woman from Kenya who, after obtaining a qualification in education in the United States, returned to Africa to promote girls' schooling and help save what threatens to become a lost generation.
Dr. Kakenya Ndaiya could by now be one of the women in Kenya donning a traditional regalia in one of the Maasai villages south of Kenya after an early marriage. But that is not the case. She built a boarding school for girls there. She said she promised that her education would benefit the entire community. The entire village collected money to pay for her journey to the United States, where she received a doctorate in education. She explains to me how she managed to jump the hurdles she faced in Kenya before leaving for the U.S.
I think for me, I had my dream was to become a teacher, and that kept me going. So I worked within a culture, leaving what is bad and pushing what is right. I managed to convince people in my community to support me to go to school. But I didn't want that to happen to other girls. That's why I created a school for girls, so that they can also have dreams and achieve their full potential.
In 2009, she founded Kakenya Center for Excellence, a girls' primary boarding school, because she believes that education will empower and motivate young Kenyan girls to become agents of change in their community and country. One of those inspired by Ndaiya is Tariro Mtomba, a gender studies student at Women's University in Africa.
We should go out there and get people to study, because if you don't study, then you don't know. It's about, I think if there were more guys who could join this and know and then educate the other people.
The number or the age of such men might not be necessary. The girl child just has to go to school. That is what Ndaiya and Women's University in Africa want to achieve. Professor Hobsadza is the head and founder of Women's University in Africa.
The word that forced me is the access. They had no access, but they had the brains. So I was providing an access for those women to come back to school, because they want to come back to school, but there's no space for them.
So for this week, we salute Professor Sadza and Dr. Ndaiya, who are making a difference. They are making efforts to ensure that the girl child in Africa gets education.
Columbus Mavhunga and Making a Difference returns at the same time next week. Before we leave you, a reminder of our main stories here on Africa Link. In the Ebola outbreak, a nurse in Spain has become the first person known to have caught the virus outside Africa. Uganda says it is monitoring 83 suspected cases of the deadly Marburg virus. And President Uhuru Kenyatta is now in the Netherlands ahead of an appearance at the International Criminal Court as a private citizen. And if you want to contact us here at Africa Link, do send a text message to 491609575950, an email to feedback.africa@dw.de, or a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. From me, Mark Caldwell, thank you for listening, and bye now.